Ce que je vous propose, c'est qu'on a des problèmes de timing avec les personnes qui doivent par ailleurs retourner chez elles. Donc je vous propose dans la foulée d'écouter Madame Melita Murco. Donc si vous pouvez venir, merci. Je vous cède directement la parole. Pour que vous puissiez, donc, Madame Melita Murco, qui est donc administrateur technique pour le programme santé mentale au bureau régional Europe de l'OMS et qui va nous parler des droits de l'homme et des normes de soins. C'est à vous.
Thank you very much. And I'm sorry that this presentation will be a little rushed, but I'm at the same time very glad that my presentation comes immediately after a philosopher who made some incredibly important points to bear in mind in the area of work that I will be talking about. First of all, I must not forget to pass on the best regards from my manager, Dr. Daniel Chisholm, who could not attend due to some prior arrangements, but who thought that it would be very important for me to take this opportunity to present to you a very important component of our work and also a very important component of our collaboration with the WHO Collaborating Center in Lille, which has to do with WHO Quality Rights Initiative, you will hear more in a second. So, sorry. Our project that I will that will be the focus of my presentation is a WHO project on long-term institutions for adults with psychosocial disability and intellectual disabilities. Right now, we are in the third phase of implementation, but the focus of my presentation will be the main product of the second phase, which is this publication, entitled Mental Health, Human Rights, and Standards of Care. This publication presents actually 98 assessments, quality assessments of institutions across the European region. We were very fortunate that the publication was met with significant international media uptake. So, for instance, we had the CNN choosing this title, European Mental Health Institution Fall Far Below the Standard, WHO Reports. Yesterday, you may recall, you saw this picture, this bed. This was what The Guardian reported. Europe's mental health institutions uniformly substandard, says WHO. What is always worth repeating, and it will be clear in the rest of the presentation, is that what we are trying to do is not to improve the institutions as they are. We firmly believe that the only way forward is actually to get rid of them and to provide quality care in the community. But at the same time, we have to be aware that hundreds of thousands of people, of our fellow human beings, fellow Europeans, still live in such institutions. And we just have to, it's our duty to protect their human rights and to be very, very active in supporting deinstitutionalization efforts across our region. I will be very quick here, just to give you some background. This project began in 2015 at a specific request by our regional director, Dr. Jakab, who had received a number of very alarming allegations and reports about horrific situation in some such institutions in Europe, and she demanded that we take action, which we did. So the challenges that we were aware of were, first of all, substandard living conditions in many such institutions, and then difficulties and obstacles in implementing deinstitutionalization plans. And just as the previous speaker mentioned, there are so many risks when you try to implement change that things become completely empty. It's like an empty phrase. Every country wants to have a deinstitutionalization plan, but then when you look at them, you see that there is no thinking behind it. And that's really, really very, very troubling. It overwhelms you with the feelings of despair very often. Poor collaboration between the health and social care sectors, it's one of the biggest challenges that we are facing. I will say just a couple of more things about that later on. And the lack of data about long-term institutions, because it was when we started this project, one of our objectives was to find out how many institutions there are in Europe and how many people live in them. Unfortunately, that was the objective of our first phase. Unfortunately, we were not very successful, and we still don't know the exact number of people or institutions. And part of the reason for that is that in many countries, they were not able to provide complete data. It was like, you know, we can give you data for those institutions owned by the health sector, but as we have no communication with the social care sector, that part is lacking. That was the case in even one third of the countries, I think. Our response was first to collect the information as much as we could, then to do quality assessments in a sample of institutions in our participating countries, to produce national reports, and the final product was actually the publication I showed to you. So in hope that we would end up with much better data than what we started with. So the project is implemented in three phases. The first one is what I just mentioned, the difficult one with collecting data, which is obviously not kept very orderly across the region. Phase two, it was throughout last year, it was the assessment of 75 facilities, but in some of them, different wards were so different that they produced separate assessment reports. So we ended up with 98 assessment reports from 24 member states and Kosovo. Phase three is now underway, and I will tell you a little bit about that at the very end. So these are the participating countries. There is difference between phase one and phase two. We lost some countries journey. France gave us, the first response was that there was a big interest to participate in the project, but then shortly after that we received a nice letter in which it was like excuse that due to some the methodology that the data collection methods that are used here and our methodology were not really compatible, and we were just told that at that moment there were not enough resources to do the work, which we understood, because really it was not easy if our categories, you know, for age groups and similar things were very different. It was time consuming, so too bad. These are the variables we looked at in phase one. We wanted to learn about the ownership of these institutions, who are they accountable to, who is responsible for inspection, independent complaint mechanisms, deinstitutionalization plans, etc. And the data on institutions included number of institutions, total number of residents, gender, age, length of stay, diagnosis, comorbidities, and staffing. We received responses from 32 countries, but very, very few countries were able to provide answers to all questions. I can just mention that Slovenia was one of those. Miraculously, they managed to give us everything, but very, very few countries were able to do that. I will show you just a couple of graphs to give you some idea. This is the ownership. So the last column is like the overall. You can see that's pretty much evenly distributed between ministries of health, social affairs, municipalities, private sector, NGOs, and others. But you may note there is difference between the EU countries and the Southeastern European countries and CIS countries, where the ministries of health are more frequently owners of such institutions in Southeastern Europe and CIS compared to the EU. The accountability, there is a lot of variation between and within these groups, but again, there is a clear difference between the Southeastern Europe CIS countries and the EU. The private sector accountability to private sector is much more present in the European countries. The age groups, here we managed to get data only from 13 countries, and it's very, very clear that the largest group of people currently living in these institutions are people older than 61. The length of stay, only 10 countries provided responses, but again, we can see that it's in many cases the people who are now there have been there for more than 10 years. For diagnosis, just quickly, 40% of people of the total number of residents for whom the diagnosis was reported. 40% are people with intellectual disabilities, 37% are people with psychiatric disorder, 23% both have both, 16% are people who also have a physical disability, and 9% are people who are diagnosed with dementia. So now moving to phase two, in which we use the quality rights, WHO quality rights methodology. This toolkit, if you are interested to know more, it's easily accessible at the WHO website. It covers five large themes that are closely related to different human rights domains. So the first theme is about an adequate standard of living, which is related to Article 28 of the Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities. Then the right to the highest attainable physical and mental health, related to Article 25. Then the third one is legal capacity, the right to exercise legal capacity and to have enjoy personal liberty, Articles 12 and 14. Then freedom from torture and abuse, that's the fourth theme, and the right to live independently in the community. So these five themes then each has a number of standards. There is a total of 25 standards that are covered, and then each standard is further broken down into criteria. So the level of analysis for us was the level of standards, which means that 98 reports that we received times 25 makes 2,450 scoring opportunities. This is our data source, and the scoring categories that I used in the Quality Rights Toolkit are achieved in full, meaning that there is evidence that the standard is fully met. Achieved partially means that there is some room for improvement. Achievement initiated clearly indicates that there is a lot of room for improvement. Not initiated, obviously marked in red, is a reason to big worry, and not applicable means that for whatever reason that particular standard is not relevant. And you can see how these scoring categories are distributed. Now, when we look specifically at each theme, you can see everything beyond the green is. There is room for improvement. I decided today to start with on the positive side, because otherwise everything is too depressing. These are bits of evidence we got for the green parts that you could see. And they are really, really important to not neglect, because they will guide our work forward. So you can see there are institutions where our assessors found that bathing and toilet facilities are adequate, modern, adapted to service users' needs, privacy is guaranteed. Then also individual recovery plans are used and reviewed regularly with service users. Contact details of legal representatives are posted in all areas of the institution. Clear information about the rights of service users is provided in written form. Staff are trained in alternative interventions to deal with crises. The policy of the institution is to grant paid employment for as many residents as possible. Service users participate in community activities and some of them work in the community. And the institution has zero tolerance policy for disrespectful communication. So it was, for me, very important to occasionally read these sentences in the report, because the rest was... believe me, very, very different story. And very often I had to stop because I would feel sometimes that I was shutting down, because it was too much of really horrific, horrific statements made. So theme one has seven standards. First one is about the building physical conditions. Second one is about sleeping conditions, then hygiene and sanitation. The fourth one is about water, food, and clothing. The fifth one is about the ability to communicate freely with the staff or other residents. The sixth one is about stimulating and welcoming environment. And the seventh is about opportunity to lead a fulfilling social and personal life. So this is roughly how the scoring, final scoring, looks like. And I want to translate this into real statements taken directly from the reports. I chose the formulations, but in many reports, the same claims are made, just using different words. So For instance, the building is dilapidated, many windows are broken, floors are uneven and with holes, doors to toilets are not wide enough for wheelchair users. There is no privacy in bathrooms, no toilet paper, no towels, no toothpaste, and no sanitary products for women. Some residents sleep on the floor. I happened to witness that during one assessment. Service users are totally isolated and excluded from community life and activities. Residents live under supervision and control. All of these very common. Then, theme two, extremely important because it deals with the right to good health, physical and mental. The first standard, here we have five. The first one is about availability of these services for anyone who might need them, free from any discrimination on the basis of ethnicity, religion, gender, etc. And here you can see that one is, let's say we can be satisfied in Europe, at least there is no discrimination in that regard. The second one is about the staff qualification and availability, of course, and the quality of mental health care that they provide. Third one is about recovery approach. I will not say anything about that because we had brilliant presentations about recovery. And you can see it's one of the I think actually it is the lowest one, the poorest standard in the analysis. Then availability of psychotropic medication and the presence of good services for general and reproductive health. There are problems everywhere here. And we can see that also from these statements. Residents are poorly informed about their treatment and are not in a position to question it. Very, very frequent statement. In some cases, the medical files of residents have not been updated for years. The number of mental health professionals is insufficient. Occasionally, there is a shortage of essential psychotropic medication in the facility. Residents face discrimination when accessing services at local hospitals. Many speakers in the Congress mentioned this problem too. Almost all residents in this institution have missing teeth. Theme three was very, very difficult for our assessors because here they encountered this conflict between the legal regulations in their countries and the articles in the convention. So they had a lot of problems because if the law in their countries allowed for full guardianship, then they didn't know what to do. Because if it's legal in the country, then how can you say that it's not initiated? Because, you know, what they found appeared to be according to the law. But, yeah. So a lot of room for improvement. But here, in most cases, not much can be done at the facility level, but rather things need to change at the system level first. So, unclear records and procedures concerning involuntary admission, widespread problem. Lack of evidence of the informed part of the consent. I will tell you this, I think something like this came in, I think, all of the reports, which tells us that we really don't know what's happening from the moment when the person reaches the service and the moment when the person signs the consent form. So the informed part is unclear. Service users are given no information about their rights upon admission. Informed consent forms signed by guardians constitute voluntary admission. Most service users are admitted on the basis of a court decision, and in many cases the court never sees the person. Movement inside and outside the facility is strictly limited, restricted. The fourth team, the freedom from torture and abuse, we have these five standards, but you will notice for standards 4.3 and 4.4, there is a lot of gray, which means that our assessors rated that as not applicable. That refers mainly to social care institutions where such practices like electroconvulsive therapy or medical experimentation simply they are not carried out. Again, a lot of room for improvement everywhere. Some examples, I will just choose this one. The staff have never heard of the CRPD, which is really, you wonder how that is possible. Then, for instance, staff do not take residents' complaints seriously. That was, in some reports, really wonderfully described from the interviews that our assessors had with the staff and residents. That simply, it was always this approach, like, you should not believe them. That is something that really needs to change urgently. And also, this includes reports of sexual abuse that are ignored. Theme five was for me, like really most challenging part, because at the time when our assessment teams were doing the field work and started calling us occasionally for some additional advice, out of 100 calls, 80 of them were about theme five. And I think it will be clear why that happened. We have four standards: housing, education and employment, participation in public and political life, and the right to be engaged in social, cultural, religious and leisure activities. So the first statement here is one of the most frequent ones, which says this institution is the end station in the existing care pathway. So this was the problem encountered by our assessors when they would go there and look at the questionnaire, which asked, do staff provide information about available housing in the community or employment or education? They did not know how to rate that question, because the facility was meant to be the last station. So how could staff inform people about something that is not and will not be available? So they were tempted to give them, like we had here, the gray areas, like not applicable. That is where it comes from. People simply thought that that's the appropriate way of rating it, like this is not applicable for this place, and whereas it should have been not initiated. Well, yes, no assisted living programs whatsoever in many countries, and major systemic obstacles to employment throughout our region, especially in some sub-regions. So these are the key findings. You can, of course, if you are interested, read much more in the report, which is available at our website. And right now we are in phase three. It was really, really clear when we started receiving the reports that we must continue, that we could not stop with the assessment and just have another report collecting dust without without any follow-up action. So we were very fortunate to receive some additional help from our regional director, so at least we are covered for one more year. And right now we have these 12 countries participating. Maybe there is room for one or two more to join us. And the whole point here is to move from assessment, quality assessment, to quality improvement. And we will start doing that in these countries. Again, we will start very small, going to one or two facilities and helping them create improvement plans. And then we will, of course, we would like to continue supporting them in implementing those plans for many years, but we will see if that is feasible. And these are just basically no need to dwell on these because it's all about the quality work in these facilities. And the role of the WHO will be to support them in capacity building activities, first of all, and of course provide technical support on as needed basis, because we know that this support will be in great demand. Thank you very much for your attention, and this is a picture. Thank you. It's a picture from one wall from the wall in one institution, which I thought has a lot of hope in it. Thank you.
Thank you, Miss Merkel. Merci beaucoup. Donc je pense que je vais vous frustrer, mais je vais me frustrer aussi puisque Madame Merkel doit prendre un avion. Madame Fleury est partie et Monsieur Bébard doit partir aussi pour prendre un train. Donc vous avez probablement beaucoup de questions, j'en ai aussi. Essayez de les poser pendant l'après-midi parce que c'est important de pouvoir aussi continuer à avoir cet éclairage international. Merci beaucoup et bon appétit.